Hello, and welcome to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the best short stories read by great actors, recorded live in the U.S. and the U.K. My name is Cedaring Fox. I'm Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
My name is Kirsty Pitt, Word Theater's U.K. founder and creative partner. Word Theater is on a mission to connect people across the globe with compelling stories delivered through performances by well-known actors from film, television, and theater. These stories reflect the colorful, complicated, and fascinating world we live in. We celebrate the power of language. Words matter.
Tom Lee is a novelist, short story writer, and essayist whose works have been published in numerous prestigious magazines and newspapers. His short story, The Current, which is featured in his collection Greenfly, was shortlisted for the Sunday Times EFG Private Bank Short Story Award, which is when we met him. Here to read The Current today is Room with a View's Julian Sands. But first, it is with great pleasure that we welcome the author, Tom Lee, who will introduce his story.
Hello, my name is Tom Lee. To hear a story of mine read so brilliantly was and is a real pleasure, as well as a very strange sensation. I have a strong memory of sitting in the Piccadilly Waterstones in London, listening to Julian read it for the first time. There was a strong breeze coming in through the window and whipping the pages around in Julian's hands as he read, but like the pro he is, it didn't faze him. It feels even stranger to listen to it now, after a 10-year gap, a gap in which many good things happened because of the story being shortlisted for the Sunday Times Prize. The thing that strikes me now about the story is how much of it was drawn directly from life, much more so than any other piece of fiction I've written. I don't think it is giving anything away about the story to say that in the year before I wrote it, my father, like the father in the story, had staged a miraculous recovery from a chronic illness. The unexpectedness of this gave me something to work with. The writing of the story began in the way it begins here, with the narrator and his brother arriving to pick up their father from some kind of residential treatment centre. I remember even now writing the third line. When we pulled into the driveway, we could see him sitting around a table in the garden with seven or eight others, all talking and smiling, their faces turned to receive the sun, which was bright and high in the sky. I remember thinking, there's something here, a tone of voice, a tension, something that can be worked through, perhaps, and The Current is the result. And now, here's Julian Sands reading the story.
Ever since my father's treatment, which in many ways had to be considered a success, it had been hard to know what to do with him. My brother and I went to pick him up from the farmhouse in Dorset, where he'd been staying for the week. When we pulled into the driveway, we could see him sitting around a table in the garden with seven or eight others, all talking and smiling, their faces turned to receive the sun, which was bright and high in the sky. He came over to the car, hugged us both fiercely, uncharacteristically so, and then led us over to the group. "These are my boys," he said to them, and then told us everyone's names. Someone brought us tea from inside the house, and a balding young man in a yellow T-shirt began to ask me a series of earnest questions about my work, my family, my plans for the future. Next to me, my brother was receiving the same treatment from someone else. Meanwhile, my father seemed to have resumed telling a story, the details of which I could not catch, but which was punctuated by comments and bursts of laughter from the rest of the group. Altogether, an air of brittle hilarity, or even joy, hung over the scene, and in this, as in other ways, they struck me as resembling nothing so much as a group of hostages, suddenly and unexpectedly given their freedom. After 10 minutes or so, my father finished his story, stood up, and began to embrace each person around the table. There were vows to email and phone and get together again soon. Emotional goodbyes that seemed excessive for people who had known each other for not even a week. My brother and I found ourselves shaking hands with each member of the group in turn. accepting their good wishes. Before we got in the car, my father made a great show of folding up his wheelchair and packing it in the boot. In the car, my father talked very rapidly, a stream of free association flitting from one subject to another, the words sometimes getting tangled up or muddled, his mind apparently moving more quickly than he could articulate. He sat in the back, his face pressed against the window, pointing out everything that went past. A vintage car similar to one his brother had owned, a pub that would have been nice for lunch, except it was past lunchtime, and anyway, he wasn't hungry. Repeatedly marvelling at the loveliness of the day, and the countryside, the hills, the blossom on the trees. How all this made him think of a holiday he and my mother had taken nearby before my brother and I were born. Throughout this, one of his feet drummed rapidly on the floor of the car. My brother asked him what they had done during the week, the nature of the treatment, but he would not be drawn on the details. Amazing people, he said, although it was not clear if he was referring to those who had been introduced in the garden, his fellow hostages, or others who had remained unseen. Don't worry, you'll hear all about it, he said, although somehow we never did. At times, he seemed exhausted by his own efforts. He would try and stop himself, closing his eyes and taking deep breaths, one hand placed across his chest, as if swearing an oath. At one point, he took a small card from his wallet and began to mouth whatever was written on it. Some kind of mantra, perhaps. But then something else caught his attention beyond the car window, and he was talking again. After an hour, we stopped at a service station just outside Dorchester. My brother went to fill up the car with petrol. I left my father in the cafe whilst I went to the toilet. I stared in the mirror for a minute, looking at a wrinkle line that was beginning to take hold around the side of my mouth, and then popped a pill out of its foil strip and swallowed it with a gulp of water from the tap. When I got back to the cafe, my father was sitting at a table with three drinks lined up in front of him. I raised my eyebrows. Tea, because I always have tea. Tango, because I like tango. And a smoothie, because I've never had one before. He looked down at a map on the table in front of him, and then took a long sip of the tango. What do you think about a little diversion? It took another hour to get to Studland Bay, and when we pulled up behind the dunes, my father got out of the car and began to undress. Oh, Jesus, said my brother. For a moment, it looked as if he was taking off everything. But when he got down to his pants, he threw the rest of the clothes in the car and set off towards the water. All the hair on his body was snowy white, and I noticed the considerable weight he, always a lean man, had put on whilst he had been ill. My brother and I climbed to the top of the dunes and watched him wade purposefully into the sea. It was beginning to get dusky and the beach was empty, but I wondered what any onlooker might have made of this man, this scene. When the water was up to his waist, he raised his arms above his head and dived in and swam. He was a strong, graceful swimmer. I had forgotten that. I don't know whether to laugh or cry, said my brother. We had not known what we would find when we went to pick him up. We had hoped for something, certainly. But this was strange. Over the next few weeks, my father called me several times a day, often late at night or early in the morning. It was clear he wasn't sleeping very much. He was always excited, desperate to tell me about something he read or seen on television, some new piece of information that had struck him forcefully, or report what he'd been up to. He had been spending a lot of time in the woods that backed onto his house, looking out for bats and owls, sometimes sleeping out overnight so that he could be woken by the dawn chorus. He had started to build a treehouse in the back garden for my son and my brother's children, although this had got him into a row with the neighbours because of its size and the way it hung over their own garden. "Fuck 'em," he said. He had joined an amateur dramatic society and written 20 or 30 letters to the council and the local paper about a range of issues, none of which had yet been replied to or published. A month after we picked him up from Dorset, perhaps with memories of that expedition still fresh in his mind, he called to suggest we take a trip to the First World War battlefields and cemeteries in northern France. His own father had fought at the Somme and the Battle of Amiens, and in the past, before he had been ill, we had sometimes talked of exactly this, a kind of pilgrimage. He had already spoken to my brother, who had pleaded work and family commitments, no doubt truthfully. "Given your situation," he said to me, "I imagine you are more flexible." "What does Diane think about this?" I said. "Well, your stepmother has moved out, temporarily." Before I could gather a response, he went on, "She's not finding it easy to adapt. We were warned about this sort of thing. Also, I said a few things that upset her. Look, it's nothing to worry about. What about this trip? We'll eat steak frites, drink pastis, that sort of thing." The fact was, I could think of no compelling reason why I could not go. My situation, as my father called it, was that my four-year-old son lived with his mother, my ex-partner Helen, and her new boyfriend at the other end of the country, and my work came in fits and starts. It felt melancholy to be so available, but the alternative, not going, staying at home, was barely more appealing. "There isn't anywhere else you'd rather go? It's not all that uplifting a destination." "But it is, it is," he said with emphasis. "That's exactly what it is." My father insisted on taking the overnight ferry from Portsmouth to St. Malo, although this was not in any way a direct route. He said there was a romance to getting a cabin and sleeping on a boat, the sense of travel as a true experience. From there, we would drive to Paris, spend the night, and then move on to the battlefields and cemeteries. By the time we boarded the ferry, there was only time to have a quick meal, watch the lights of the shore recede from the deck, and then find the way to our cabin. It was the first of several nights sharing a room with my father, and I do not think we had ever done it before as adults. His personal, intimate habits, the way he took his socks off last when he undressed, and then put them on first thing in the morning, the rather horrible way he spat out after cleaning his teeth, made him seem alien, unknown to me. My own rituals, unexposed now for some time, suddenly seemed old mannish, even shameful. The plastic guard I wore to stop my teeth grinding, and which left a bloody taste in my mouth in the morning, the earplugs, the pill I took discreetly in the tiny bathroom to help me sleep. My father gave no sign of being similarly discomforted. He was still awake reading a newspaper when I turned out the light above my bed. When the ferry PA system woke me in the morning to announce that we had docked, he was standing between the beds performing Tai Chi exercises. It was clear that since Dorset, my father had calmed down considerably. Even in his more manic moods, the chatter was not so continuous, so rambling, although his preoccupations were often no less surprising. These highs were also now interspersed with quieter, more brooding periods, as if some of his intensity had turned inward. One of these moods seemed to descend on him as we drove out of St. Malo, as it had the previous day on the way to Portsmouth. It was as if the movement, the road, brought it on. He stared out of the window, at times fidgeting with the map that lay on his knees, perhaps lost in contemplation of the trip ahead and whatever it meant to him. 10 kilometers or so beyond Rennes, he turned away from the window and asked me what I wanted done with my body after my death. whether this question had just occurred to him or was indicative of the general drift of his thoughts, I couldn't say. He did not wait for me to reply. "The Tibetans have a tradition of sky burial," he said. "I've been researching it online. Incredible resource." For a moment, he seemed to have lost his thread, and I pictured his mind floating off to the far reaches of cyberspace. "The body is cut up and placed around the mountaintop, and vultures and other birds of prey eat the flesh. They believe that the spirit leaves the body in death, so there's no need to preserve it. There are practical reasons, too. But it's also an act of generosity, giving yourself to other animals to sustain them. There are places you can do it here now. In Europe, I mean. There's something rather beautiful in the idea, don't you think? I'd much rather that than be turned to dust or left to rot in a grave. I've always rather liked the idea of a Viking burial. Sent off in a burning ship. Sword laid at my side, etc., etc. I said this a little flippantly, an attempt to engage with my father's preoccupations. But I was struck, quite abruptly, by an image of myself, stretched out in a long boat, eyes closed, a faint smile on my lips, but apparently dead. The skin of my hands and feet beginning to blacken and catch fire. "Do you actually care what happens to you?" my father said, rather irritably. "When I'm dead, I'm dead," I said. "I suppose I'm a materialist about these things. For me, the spirit dies too, whatever that is." "I'll tell you a story," he said. 20 years ago, scientists carried out an experiment where they killed a dog, killed it humanely, drained its blood, and replaced it with some kind of preserving solution. 3 hours later, they put the blood back in and brought the dog back to life. Only problem was the animal was completely mad, psychotic. Every time they tried, the same result. They had to put all the dogs down. I did not know what conclusions I was supposed to draw from this. When he did not continue, I looked over at him. He said vaguely, and then turned his attention back to the window. We stopped for lunch in a village just beyond Laval. We sat outside in the pleasantly shady medieval square with a bowl of moule marinara and a glass of wine each, and it was possible to feel like we were on holiday. My father seemed to have relaxed and was talking about his own father, stories I had heard many times before, but was happy to hear again. Before the war, my grandfather had worked on the trams in Blackpool and then for a chain of local cinemas. The cinemas all showed the same films, but there was only ever one print, so he cycled between them with reels in the basket on the front of his bike, delivering and collecting them in a constant rotation to keep the films playing. When he went to enlist in 1914, he told them how he was 16 years old, and the recruitment sergeant suggested he walk up and down the street and come in and tell them again. A picture of him taken before, when he'd always hung around in my father's house. A formal shot, standing feet apart with some kind of cane braced between his hands, heartbreakingly young in his uniform. He had made a friend in France, Stan Cope, another 16-year-old from South Wales, who was killed 2 months before the end of the war. We were going to visit Stan's grave in Amiens. When we got back to the car, my father asked to drive. He had not driven throughout his illness or since, as far as I knew. "You can't do it all on your own," he said, and held out his hand for the keys. At the slip road to the motorway, 2 hitchhikers were standing on the hard shoulder with their thumbs out. "No one picks up hitchhikers anymore, Dad," I said, but he was already slowing down. My father interrogated them as he drove, switching his attention between the back seat and the road ahead in a way that did not strike me as entirely safe. They were Bernard and Patty, a young Dutch couple on their way to Paris to stay with friends. Bernard had a shaven head, a ring through his lip, and orange and red flames tattooed the length of his forearms. She was very pale-skinned, with short, bleached white hair and bright blue eyes. They were students in Amsterdam, both 22 years old, and had spent the summer travelling around France. Bernard was writing a thesis on prehistoric cave painting, and they had been visiting important sites up and down the country. Bernard was forthcoming on all of this, eager to talk in his perfect, almost accentless English. Patty sat silently, smiling slightly and benignly, sometimes with her eyes closed. "What's the story with those tattoos?" my father asked Bernard. Bernard shrugged. "No story. A friend of mine did them. I thought they'd look good. You like them?" It was a statement rather than a question. "Not worried you might regret them when you're older," my father said. "My age, perhaps, or even my son's," he indicated me with a thumb. "I don't want to be the sort of person who has regrets." He was a little annoyed by the question, or pretending to be. "Good answer," said my father thoughtfully. "Good answer." There was silence for several minutes, and then my father said, "There's nothing more beautiful than a pregnant woman, right, Bernard?" Bernard laughed. I looked around at Patty. I had not noticed the way her dress tightened around the swell of her belly. She had her palms placed on either side of it, instinctively or absent-mindedly, the way pregnant women often do, as Helen had done when she was pregnant with our son. Patty saw me looking at her, and her smile widened. I closed my eyes and pretended to be asleep as the conversation went on between my father and Bernard. My father began to philosophize about the raising of children. He felt, he had never heard him express views on this or seen evidence of it before, that modern parenting was so neurotic and controlling that it had created a world for children that was utterly dry, sterile, and conformist. Children needed to experience fear, take risks, be free. "I've seen it with my own grandchildren," he said. I flicked my eyes open at this, but then closed them again without speaking. Bernard agreed with him. He talked about his and Patty's plans for their child, from the home birth to the long trips they would take, whilst it was still small, the virtues of openness, innocence, and courage that they wanted to instill. My father described an old tradition that had been revived in Russia of baptizing young children by dipping them in holes cut through the frozen rivers and lakes. "Some say it erases sin," my father said. "The more prosaic view is that it's good for the immune system and vitality in general. A little extreme, I'll admit." I had read about this too. Some children were said to have died this way. "Perhaps a little," Bernard said tolerantly. "Right," my father went on. "But my point is..." I pretended to be asleep, and then I was asleep. When I woke, I could not tell how much time had passed. My father was still talking. "It's life and death, you know, two sides of the same coin, the yin and the yang, etc., etc. In some ways, after all that, I don't give a fuck, but in other ways, I do. I absolutely do. It gives you a different perspective, that's all. Maybe that makes sense, maybe it doesn't." In the mirror, I could see Bernard nodding soberly, apparently absorbing what my father had been saying. I wondered what I had missed, what essential conversation this might have been the conclusion to. Regardless, my father seemed satisfied that he had expressed himself as fully as he was possible. We were approaching Paris, and the rest of the journey, until we dropped Bernard and Patty off at the station on the outskirts of the city, no one spoke. My father gave Bernard his email and phone number and insisted that they come and stay with him when the child was born. Bernard tried to give my father money for petrol, but he refused. He hugged them both, and I awkwardly did the same. "Nice kids," he said when we were back in the car. "Stunning girl." "Yes," I said. My father had booked us into a faded and pretentious tourist hotel in the Latin Quarter. There was a liveried porter on the door, embossed stationery, and a small, grimy window in our room that looked out over the domes of the Pantheon, which no doubt accounted for the excessive cost. The room was pokey, and full of odd angles, evidently subdivided from a more generous space. Crammed into it was a double bed with an ornate headboard, instead of the two singles my father had reserved. I ran a hot bath and lay in it, staring at the ceiling. Through the wall, I could hear my father on the phone, with long pauses whilst the person on the other end of the line spoke. I could not make out what he was saying, but the tone became steadily more irritable. And then there was a somehow deeper silence, and I knew that my father had hung up. He began whistling, always one of his habits. I lay there for another 10 minutes whilst the water cooled, and then got out. Back in the bedroom, he was standing looking out of the window, still whistling. "Diane says hello," he said, without turning round. "Everything okay?" "Oh, fine, fine. It's cold there, apparently. Raining." "Right," I said. "You know the history of this place?" He meant the Pantheon. Louis XIV, or maybe it was Louis XV. Anyway, he was dying of a mysterious fever, and in his prayers he promised to build a church to St. Genevieve if she cured him. The fever passed, and this is what he built. Not the most beautiful building, but it has a certain grandeur, I think. Later on, after the Revolution, they turned it into a mausoleum. Victor Hugo, Voltaire, Rousseau, those guys." "I didn't know that," I said. He turned around and grinned. "So, now you do." He went into the bathroom to wash, and I called my son to wish him good night. I tried to do this every night, even though Helen had let me know that it was an inconvenience for her, and perhaps not much fun for me or him either. Then I called my brother to let him know we were still in one piece. He laughed sympathetically and told me to keep him updated. "Rather you than me," he said. "Cometh the hour, cometh the man," I said. The evening was still warm, and we had dinner sitting outside at the restaurant next to the hotel. We had steak, which came very bloody, and my father ordered a 50-euro bottle of red wine that I said I wasn't drinking. His mood had turned fidgety, distracted, and he barely ate. A small, mangy dog sat pleadingly near our table, and he cut off strips of his meat and threw it on the ground. My father started to talk about Stan Cope. 2 days after the end of the Battle of Amiens, in August 1918, the beginning of the end of the war, Stan collapsed with a brain aneurysm. I had never heard this before, or had forgotten it. I had assumed he had been killed in the battle. He was sharing a cigarette with my dad and just keeled over. He might have got a knock on the head, but it could have happened to him anyway, war or no war. Strange way to go. Still, they buried him with the war dead, as they should. My grandfather was 20 when he got back from the war. He married soon after, had 6 children, of which my father was the youngest, and lived for another 75 years. He spoke freely about his years in France and did not seem traumatized by it, although he used to say that he had seen enough of the rest of the world for one lifetime and never went further than Manchester ever again. "Do you think they'll get married?" My father had changed the subject. "Who?" "Helen and Jim." Jim was my ex's new boyfriend. "I haven't the faintest idea." "Well, do you think perhaps you should take an interest? It might have implications for you." For all his talk over the last weeks, my father had not spoken to me about his illness, treatment, or recovery, if that's what it was. I sensed some kind of taboo around it. His or my own, I couldn't say. As if to confront it directly might break whatever spell had been cast. The subject struck me as exhausting, irrelevant, and dangerous all at the same time, but I felt moved to broach it now, when abruptly the waiter arrived to take our plates away. My father ordered a coffee, and then by the time the waiter left, the moment seemed to have passed. I went inside to use the toilet. There was a queue, and when I came out, my father was not at our table. I thought perhaps he had gone to a room in the hotel to get something. The waiter brought his coffee, but he still did not appear. Someone across the square shouted, and I looked across to the giant columned portico of the Pantheon. The two columns furthest to the right were covered in scaffolding, presumably to allow cleaning or restoration work to the frieze that lay across the width of the portico. And 3/4 of the way up, perhaps 100 feet off the ground and climbing, was my father. It took me a few moments to absorb this, and by the time I had stood up and run over, passers-by were already beginning to gather at the foot of the building and watch. The base of the scaffolding was boarded up, but on one side, an access door was open. Either my father had spotted this from the restaurant, or had just been lucky. Now he was scaling the ladders at speed and in very bad light. The crowd continued to gather. People called to him to come down. My father carried on, apparently oblivious, intent on whatever mission he had set himself. Something stopped me from calling out to him myself, shock perhaps, a reluctance to identify or associate myself with him, the knowledge that even if he heard me amongst other voices, it would likely make no difference. When he reached the top level, he walked to the left hand of the scaffolding and climbed onto the narrow ledge and underneath the frieze so that his back was pressed against the figures. He began to make his way slowly along the ledge. Someone shouted, "Don't do it!" in French, and someone else laughed. He stumbled slightly, steadied himself. He looked around and then down. He was a long way up, tiny against the looming mass of the church. But I was sure he was smiling. He held out his phone and seemed to take a photo of the view or of himself. I couldn't tell. It seemed to take forever for him to get down. I counted 11 ladders. Halfway down the final one, he missed his footing and fell a few feet to the ground. The police and an ambulance had arrived, and the crowd were pushed back and told to move on. I identified myself and was let through. My father was shaking, elated. 2 policemen were asking him questions, and a paramedic was holding his arm. "Cold up there," he said to me. "I can imagine," I said, but that's all I could say. I felt my legs begin to buckle, and I sat down on the ground next to him, utterly drained. We got back to the hotel at 3 a.m., and I took a pill to knock me out. At the police station, my father had given a statement in which he offered no explanation for his stunt, except that he was a little drunk and happy to be in Paris. He was given a warning and told repeatedly that what he had done was very dangerous for him and for others. But the 2 officers seemed to feel they were dealing with a classic English eccentric rather than a criminal or a lunatic. They shook hands with both of us and wished us a good trip. At the hospital, an X-ray of his right arm showed a small fracture, and a nurse put it in a sling. I slept lightly, despite the pill, and from time to time, through my grogginess, I was aware of my father sitting in the chair by the window or moving around the room. When I woke up around 10, I was lying diagonally across the bed and there was no sign of him. But I did not seem to have any worry left in me. I had a shower and went downstairs to have breakfast. He came in just as my food arrived, his arms strapped, his hair wild, and still wearing the clothes from the night before. He sat down and poured himself some orange juice with his good arm. "Beautiful day," he said. He hadn't been able to sleep, so had sat up reading before going out to find an early coffee and watch the sun come up. When the Pantheon had opened at 9, he had gone down into the crypt to look at the tombs. He showed me a small lead model of the church that he had bought himself from the gift shop and then handed over a T-shirt that had a picture of the Eiffel Tower, and above it the words, "J'adore Paris." "A memento of our trip," he said, almost sheepishly. "You crazy old bastard," I said. "Perhaps, but don't tell your stepmother, and not so much of the old." He finished his coffee and stood up. "We should get going. It's blue skies out there." He went upstairs to pack. It was around 3 hours driving to Amiens, where my grandfather and Stan Cope had fought, and the cemetery where Stan was buried. After lunch, we would go to the Somme battlefields. We had a hotel booked in Arras for the night. My father was quiet again. Once we had navigated our way out of Paris, we didn't speak, but the silence felt companionable. About 50 kilometers from Amiens, we crested a hill, and suddenly we were amongst field after field of sunflowers. From there, the land flattened out onto the plains of the Somme Valley, and it was not hard to imagine vast armies inching backwards and forwards across the land. Soon we began to see the signs for the battlefields and cemeteries. We stopped at one of the roadside flower sellers, and my father bought a bunch of red and yellow tulips. Saint-Pierre Cemetery was a modest-sized, unspectacular place in a nondescript suburb of Amiens, backed on three sides by uniformly spaced yew trees. We walked through the iron entrance gates and past the stone of remembrance engraved, "Their name liveth forevermore." The sun was very bright, and the clean white Portland stone of the headstones stood out like teeth against the immaculate green lawns. My father had brought a map, and we found Stan's grave easily, halfway along the final row. Below the cross, it read, "Private S. Cope, the Queen's 28th, August 1918, age 19. My father laid the tulips next to the headstone and began to pick fussily at the neatly mown grass around it, as if determined to find weeds. I wandered along the row. Some of the dead were younger than Stan and were startled by the sound of my father's voice. At first, I did not know who he was addressing, but then I recognized the poem. I did not know what my father had read poetry, let alone knew any by heart. Perhaps he had learnt it at school as I had. Standing in front of Stan's grave, his eyes closed, his bad arm hanging across his chest, again he seemed unfamiliar to me. And somehow, briefly, I can think of no other word, heroic. What passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns, only the stuttering rifles' rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. No mockeries now for them, no prayers nor bells, nor any voice of mourning save the choirs. The shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells and bugles calling for them from sad shires. His voice began to crack, but he kept going with some effort. When he got to the end, he sat down on the grass, buried his head in the crook of his fractured arm, and began properly to cry. It began as a steady sob, moving on to a wail, and then a kind of keening of pure, uninhibited sorrow. Whatever brittle barrier had penned this in over the last weeks had broken. It seemed to me it came out torrentially, ecstatically. I did not know whether to try and stop him or at least move him along out of the cemetery and back to the car, somewhere more discreet, although we seemed beyond that now. There were a few other people walking amongst the graves, but we did not seem to have attracted anyone's attention. Perhaps it was unremarkable in a place like this. I hesitated to intervene with him. Such was the elemental force of his emotion. He did not seem to be trying to stop. Then I sat down too and put my arm around him, and he wept into my chest. His face was red and swollen, and his eyes bloodshot. But by the time we drove out of the car park, my father had recovered his composure. We had planned to go on another hour or so and find somewhere for lunch. But as soon as we crossed a bridge over the Somme River, I had not realized that it was this that gave the area and the battle its name. He asked me to pull over. On both sides of the road was lined with fields of corn, 6 to 8 feet high. My father got out of the car, and after walking up and down for a minute, disappeared into it. For perhaps 2 minutes, I sat in the car, the engine still on. I took the strip of pills out of my wallet and swallowed two with a gulp of the flat Diet Coke that my father had been drinking the day before. Then I pulled the car further off the road, got out, and locked it. In among the corn, there was the sound of water. The stalks were bent and trampled where my father had passed through. I went on for several minutes to where the field gave way to a small, pebbly beach on the riverbank. The river was narrow here, perhaps 15 meters wide, and ran quickly. There were willows trailing their branches in the water on the opposite side. My father's clothes and the sling for his arm lay on the beach. I shaded my arms against the sun and spotted him out in the river, a little downstream. His arms were in the air, and at first I thought he was struggling in the current. But then I saw he was gesturing for me to come in. I began to undress, laying my clothes next to my father's. The skin of my ankles prickled as it touched the water, and I thought for a second of children dipped in freezing lakes and rivers. I thought of the places we were yet to visit, the strange resonance of their names, Theopfal, Ypres, Passchendaele. I thought I felt the familiar, peaceful flood of the pills begin to wash over me, but it was too soon for that. I went into the current.
We hope you've enjoyed Julian Sands' reading of The Current by Tom Lee. To support Word Theatre and our authors, you can purchase their works at bookshop.org/shop/wordtheatre. And we really hope that you will jump in and become a supporting annual patron or enthusiast member. Spread the word to your friends. Word Theatre is on a mission to make a better world one story at a time. And we really thank you for joining us. Do spread the word. Special thanks to Jonathan Sachs for composing our theme music, and thank you to Jason Lee, our podcast editor. Until next week, signing off.